Some of the most necessary and important things around us are so common that we often stop seeing them or even thinking about them. But when it comes to something as vital as soil, we really need to take the time to pay attention and keep it healthy. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk. We welcome Kevin Sheshow, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Besides providing information and education to area farmers on crops and soils and so forth, he provides information and education in both home and commercial horticulture. So he coordinates the Master Gardener Volunteer Program for that Tri-County area. He manages the teaching and display garden at the Spooner Ag Research Station, and he organizes horticulture workshops and field days. He has a special interest in soil ecology and composting. He loves that as well. He's got his master's and BS in soil science from UW-Madison and UW-River Falls. And he joins us today from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Superior. Kevin, welcome to Garden Talk.
Good morning, Larry.
Great to have you with us. You know, once in a while, of course, my students, I have advised students here on campus, and when they take a soils class, they'll sometimes say, well, I'm taking Dirt 301. And I say, well, don't let your professor hear you say Dirt 301. Soil is more complex than just dirt, isn't
it? Oh, yes, it is, Larry. And I get that comment all the time, too. And anybody who knows me and who's taken my classes or heard me talk about soil knows that I'm a stickler for that definition. But, I get on my soapbox, I give my little speech about, you know, the difference between soil and dirt. You know, of course, dirt is what you find underneath your fingernails after digging in the soil, or you bring it in on your shoes in the house. But, in the end, I really don't mind so much what people call it, as long as they appreciate the value of it and how important it is. But I just think soil is just so much more becoming of the resource.
Yeah.
It just rolls off your tongue so much better.
I would agree with you on that. And, you know, somebody asked me the other day, somebody not that old, actually, daughter-like in the 10-year-old range, How does soil come? How do you make soil, Dad?
Yeah, the ABCs.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. How does soil come to be?
Well, you know, it all starts with geology, and you know, when I teach the Master Gardener training soils presentation, or and I've been taught this as a soils scientist, I guess, is, you know, it all starts with apparent material, and just like we come from parents, soil. As soil scientists, we talk about the parent material that our soils are born from. And in Wisconsin, we are blessed with just all kinds of varied geology. And that's basically because of the glaciers that, you know, ripped through this region, you know, thousands of years ago. And Wisconsin is just so varied in our landscape and in the type of parent materials that we have to develop our soil. So that's the beauty of living in a, you know, a state like Wisconsin, is we have lots of different change in topography and lots of different soils. In fact, Wisconsin has well over 600 named and classified soils all across the state. And, you know, anybody who travels knows that, you know, this isn't Iowa where it's flat, or Nebraska or southern Illinois. So, we're very fortunate. So, yeah, it starts with those rocks and sands and silts. And that's what gives us our soil after thousands of years of development.
And we even have a state soil, but I'm not sure every state in the nation has a state soil. But we've got Antigo silt loam.
Yes, we do. Antigo silt loam. It's our official Wisconsin state soil. And that's another tidbit or piece of trivia I like to share with folks. And of all people, it was pioneered by a professor from UW-Madison by the name of Francis D. Hole.
Wonderful guy.
Yes, he was.
Were you lucky enough to have a class from Francis?
No, actually, he was retired. He was an emeritus professor when I came on campus in Madison. But I did get to hear his passion and his violin playing, and he came into the soils department there a few times. And actually, as an undergraduate, I got to listen to him speak up at UW-River Falls as well. And just a wonderful man, a true advocate for this resource. So I'm trying to. I'm not going to say I'm following in his footsteps, but I really think it's important that we educate people about this resource and let them know just how doggone important it is.
I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, Kevin Shesho, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett Sawyer in Washburn Counties. I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mehler Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Mary had a question, sent something in on Facebook. She said, I have sandy soil and my veggie garden requires a lot of water. What can I add to the soil that's going to help on a long-term basis and then also provide some nutrients?
Yes, that's one of our challenges with our sandier soils is that they have a very low, what we call nutrient holding capacity or CEC, cation exchange capacity. There's just not a lot of, I always make the analogy to a sponge. And sandy soils have a very small sponge and they can't hang on to a lot of water or nutrients. So long-term, the best thing we can do for most of our soils, but on sands in particular, is add lots of organic matter, whether it be compost or manures or purchased topsoil or anything you can do to add organic matter in that situation. So it's a long-term process on sands in particular, but, you know, that's the challenge with that small sponge in the sandy soil.
Yeah. Is that making a soil healthy then? What do you mean when you say, or what do we mean when we say that soil is healthy?
Well, it's in its simplest definition, soil health is basically the capacity of that soil to function and to function long term and in a sustainable way so that we, you know, it does what we want it to do. And, you know, if you've got a garden soil that is in need of help, you know, it needs a checkup, right? Just like if you're not feeling good, you know, and everybody has a little bit, you know, subjective definition of what healthy means. Mm-hmm. But I think in the most run, it's just trying to do what we can to enhance the soil physical properties, chemical properties, and biology. And the biology is what we really want to emphasize when it comes to soil health.
I can, and I'm wondering about unhealthy, making soil unhealthy. I was thinking back to my days as a young guy in the Cottage Grove area, where there were, or Stoughton area, where there was a lot of tobacco growing, and tobacco would take the nutrients right out of soil, and kind of is that making it? That's probably making it kind of unhealthy, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, it's a balancing act. I mean, you know, some people refer to the soil as a bank of nutrients and, you know, all the things that plants need to grow. And certain crops are high-demand crops. There's no question about it. You know, a lot of our fruit and vegetable crops have a high demand for nutrients, and they'll pull those nutrients out of the soil. And when we harvest the crop, well, what do we do with those nutrients? We remove it from that soil. And if we're not, you know, looking out for the interest of our soil and adding those nutrients and organic materials back into the soil over time, yeah, we can deplete that soil and it's no longer productive and healthy. And we've seen that time and time again with some of our agricultural practices early on with, planting too much and not replenishing the soil. So it's a balancing act.
And you can probably, I don't know, the best way to, if you're going to check the health of your soil, probably a soil test, or is that not the best way?
Oh, no, that's definitely, I think anybody who's listened to your show over the years, Larry, knows that, you know, we're always advocating, you know, don't guess, take the test. And, you know, there's a number of ways you can do that. The best way, of course, is to send a sample into a state-certified lab that has, you know, nice analytical equipment that's calibrated, and we get good analysis, and we also get the recommendations that come with it. So, yeah, a soil test is important, but sometimes people, you know, gardeners, farmers, you know, just by, you know, getting to know your soil, and that's just the physical part of it, like I mentioned earlier, is, you know, dig in it, smell it, feel it. I know I've heard some people even, you know, they'll taste it and you know, do all that. So you can do a little, you know, on-site diagnostic work with your soil. So the physical part is something that is part of, you know, recognizing the soil's health. And then, you know, of course, chemically, that's where the soil test comes in. And pH and the amount of nutrients is what we're looking at there. But then the third piece, which is one that's most often misunderstood or not understood as well, is that biology. And, you know, anybody who knows what a good, healthy soil should look like, they're saying, oh, you know, I saw these angleworms or I saw some sow bugs or millipedes or something crawling around in that, kind of like the compost pile. But
yep.
There's all kinds of life in the soil that we just don't appreciate. And that's where I think the adding organic material feeds that biology. And that's what replenishes the soil. And it's that all those things together is what keeps that soil sustainable and doing the right things for us.
Yeah. I think Brian from Appleton has kind of a related comment or question. Brian, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling with the question, how does the, like, organic composition as that breaks down, does that figure into what makes the soil soil?
Yeah. So organic matter, as it decomposes, is it becoming soil or at least a part of soil?
Most definitely. The organic matter fraction of a soil is so influential on that soil's sustainability and its ability to produce healthy crops and you know plants. It's only a small portion, anywhere from 1 to 5%, maybe a little bit higher than that. So as you add these high-carbon organic materials, whether they be grass clippings or the manures or straw, eventually through microbial activity and all this biology I mentioned, it breaks it down into simpler and simpler forms, and all the exudates and all that biology causes the soil particles to stick together, and that's what gives us our structure. And I mean, it's just it's where it all starts. And over time, that organic matter turns into humus, and that's what is the long-term stable fraction of organic matter that keeps our soils nice and dark. A soil that's washed away with all of its organic matter is usually light-colored, tan.
Right.
A nice dark soil has lots of humus in it. So, definitely organic matter is so important, and it just takes time.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Fred in Minong, your turn. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Say, I'm a senior citizen that lives in senior housing, and I'm allowed to put a planter outside to grow some veggies if it's my desire to do such. And I'm a tomato addict, and I've got a planter that's plastic. It's about 2 foot diameter, 2 foot high, and there's no holes in the bottom or anything like that. And I have plans to try and grow some tomatoes next spring. And I was wondering how best to prepare the soil in there. Should I use sand and gravel in the bottom? Should I put holes for seepage in the bottom? Should I have rocks in there that maintain or hold moisture? Or what type of soil is best maybe for growing the tomatoes?
Yeah, so now we're talking containerized gardening, and we have lots of options. First thing I definitely do is flip that container over, and if you got a drill or have somebody who can help you drill some holes in the bottom of that thing, we absolutely need bottom drainage in all of our containers. So go ahead, get those holes drilled. And then from there, you have lots of different options. You said it was 2 feet by 2 feet, so that's a good enough size pot for a larger plant like a tomato. You can buy potting soil if you have access to, you know, a greenhouse, local greenhouse, you know, maybe up in Solon Springs, or if you want to go down to Spooner, or maybe there's something there in Minong. But you can start with a potting mix and cut it with some organic matter. You know, we don't want native soil necessarily to go into our containers. You know, you have to mix that, because once you take native soil out of its natural environment and put it into a container, those soil particles are disturbed, and you often end up with compaction.
I figured I'd probably use the potting soil, but I was wondering about should there be rock or gravel in the bottom and then different soil on top of that? Or
no, I'm not a big fan of putting a lot of stuff in the bottom of the container. I don't know about you, Larry.
No, I don't. I just put the potting soil in there and potting mix in there, and that's the way she goes. But I have holes in the bottom for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I appreciate your comments. Thanks a lot.
Yep, you'll need to remember it. Remember, too, Fred, that you're going to need to do a regular watering routine with it, and you're going to also probably, especially with tomatoes, at some point you're going to be needing some fertilizing to go in there, too.
That's a challenge with containers is how do you keep them adequately watered, especially if you've got them sitting outside on a patio or on a deck. You know, they're exposed to all that sun. The root ball, you know, is above ground. And keep a vigilant about the watering. And like Larry said, if the tomato looks like it's needing a little boost of fertilizer, don't be afraid to add some. But depending on what you start with, there may be enough in that pot initially.
Yeah, that's for sure. Kevin Sheshow, our guest today, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here on this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Kevin Sheshow from UW Extension. He provides lots of information and education for farmers, but also for homeowners and commercial horticulture businesses as well. So it's great to have him along to talk with you. Maybe you have a question. What about your soil? Maybe it's just about plants that you're putting into that soil. Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Heidi in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. A few years ago, I was living in northern Trempealeau County, and I tried to grow a Three Sisters garden, and I used sweet corn and green beans, and instead of a regular squash, I used zucchini squash. Well, the zucchini flowered but didn't produce. The corn didn't produce at all, but the green beans thrived. So I'm wondering, if I tried that again, what could I do to the soil to help that along and actually make that a success?
Well, was this in just an in-ground garden spot, just a patch of ground out, you know, behind the house?
Yeah, it was out behind the house in what used to be prairie land.
Okay. Well, you know, like we mentioned earlier, you can always start with a soil test and just kind of get that baseline information just to make sure that there's not something out of whack. You know, the pH is one thing that we know can influence nutrient availability, and sometimes plants don't do so well when it's acid. But, you know, the fact that you didn't have flowers on that zucchini, there could have been, you know, a pollination issue there.
Or did you have flowers but no zucchini?
Yeah, flowers, but no zucchini.
So she had flowers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did have flowers.
So the flowers didn't get pollinated for you.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's necessarily related to the soil. I mean, sometimes there's other issues related to temperature and insects helping with pollination and, you know, getting the male and female flowers together. But from a soil's perspective, I guess, you know, getting back to my earlier comments, if you feel that soil is in need of amendment, you know, by all means, look for ways to add organic materials, you know, shredded leaves or compost, or, you know, if you want to go buy some potting soil and mix it in, or if you have access to composted manure, that would be even better yet. So it might be that you just, you know, not every year's a success and every year's different. So it could be that you just have to reassess the situation and, you know, maybe by improving your soil with some of these organic matter additions and getting your soil test, you'll improve it enough that you'll be more successful next time.
You know, today or now wouldn't be a bad time to get that test because probably the soil testing labs aren't as busy as they will be next spring, and then the ground isn't frozen yet.
Yeah, fall is a great time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Heidi.
All right.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Jim in New Auburn, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Yes, I have two questions. One is probably simpler to answer, so let me lay that on you first. I often hear of sandy soils being amended with organic matter, but my perception, may be mistaken, is that sand and organic matter still don't have great water retention characteristics, but I never hear any suggestion being made to add finer particles to the soil, such as clay. Would that be an appropriate amendment for a very large-grained soil?
Sure. Yeah, I understand. I mean, anybody who knows, you know, about soil particles, there's sand, silt, and clay. And, you know, in different proportions, we get different textures that we, you know, label, like a loam soil or a silty loam soil or a clay loam. In this case, there's nothing wrong with trying to change some of that particle distribution with those finer materials like silts and clays. But our challenge is trying to distribute those tiny, you know, particles so that they're evenly distributed. Oftentimes what happens when you take a fine particle like clay and add it to sand, you can get something that resembles more like concrete.
Concrete, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you do, if you want to pursue that, you know, method, I would do it in very small amounts, and maybe you mix that clay type soil material that you can find, you know, someplace else, but mix it in with your organic matter and try to get it distributed so you're not having that real contrast in particle size. It can be done, but I'm very cautious about how much you add. And, you know, you can give it a try. Organic matter over time may take 20 years, but you can bring up that soil organic matter so that it does hold more water.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. My second question is that I live in a part of the state where surface mining for silica sand is rampant. And I have been told that, and of course, as part of the process, the topsoil and the subsoil is removed and stored in piles until the mineral is removed, and then it's put back in place. But that's so that those soils are in large piles for a few years, typically, I think. And I have been told that when that soil is put back in place, that it is sterile and not very productive. Is there a truth to that? And if so, what can be done to correct the non-productivity of that soil?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I guess I'm just trying to get an idea about, you take this topsoil and it's scraped off like they often do when they store it in a pile. Over time, you might get some oxidation and leaching of nutrients from that topsoil because it's been disturbed and sitting in this big pile. But the mass of that is such that I wouldn't think there's going to be a lot of changes in that nutrients of that particular material physically. And, you could argue biologically, you've upset the balance of that native topsoil from that physical distribution. But the pile itself shouldn't change all that much. I think the challenge any time we do restoration, and, we've had to deal with these situations continuously, with pipelines and with other mining sites and gravel pits, when they go to restore that site, how do you recreate that native soil profile that was once there? And that is the challenge in trying to restore these sites back to more, productive characteristics. And it's never going to be the same as what Mother Nature, set there, because it takes, like I said, thousands of years for that to happen. So I think we've got enough experience and science and engineering to restore those sites adequately. It's never going to be like it was prior to disturbing it. But I don't really see that soil should be sterile from sitting there for a number of years. It's not going to be, quite the same, but...
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. We had an email from Bill in Marshfield who would like you to comment on vermicomposting and its application to improving the soil.
Well, for those that don't know about vermicomposting, that's I'm assuming that's German, for worm. Mm-hmm. But you're using worms intentionally. Oftentimes, it's in a bucket or some kind of container where you put your scraps in there, and the worms, do what they do. They love to eat all that organic material, and their poop is mm-hmm. what is called the castings, and that's this wonderful byproduct that comes from vermicomposting. And that is, one of those gardener gold nuggets, those little tiny prills, contain all kinds of organic material, of course, because that's what the worm ate. But there's also microbial, particles or organisms in there that were in the worm's gut. And that's what makes that product so valuable. So, yeah, adding that to the soil is going to, provide benefits that we couldn't do without the worm. So I'm a big fan of vermicomposting, however you do it, and that material that you got, put it back into your soil or into a potting mix.
Absolutely,
it's great stuff.
Peter in Baldwin emailed us, too, and wondered how you acidify soil for blueberries. It's slightly acid, his soil. He's from Baldwin.
Sure, sure. And anybody who grows blueberries or azaleas or any of those we call acid-loving plants knows that we got to get that pH down below 5. Below 5 is ideal. 4.5 to 5 is kind of what we're shooting for. And that's getting down there as far as the acidity. And, you know, the quickest way is with aluminum sulfate or elemental sulfur. And basically the chemistry there, you're attracting hydrogen to those sulfate particles, and that's what kind of makes a weak acid like sulfuric acid, and that's what causes that pH to go down or the soil to become more acidic. It does take a little bit of time for that reaction in the soil to occur, but those are the two products that are most commonly recommended, either aluminum sulfate or elemental sulfur. There's muir acid, and some people want to use sphagnum moss that's slightly acidic, or pine needles that's acidic. Those organic or natural products just take a little bit longer to react in the soil and may not get you to where you need to be quick enough. But if you can do that ahead of planting your blueberries or plants, that's best.
Yeah, absolutely. Marlis in Merrill. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have moss growing in my perennial beds, and it's not just on the north side. I want to know how I can kill it or what I have to do to the soil to get rid of the moss. It just keeps spreading all over in the beds.
Must have a shady and damper area. Or
It's on the west side.
Okay. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, you know, moss in lawns and in our gardening areas is not uncommon. You know, it's usually a sign that, you know, something's not quite right because the moss is surviving and the lawn or the perennials or shrubs or whatever is, you know, isn't enough. Yeah, or they're not providing enough competition, you know, to keep the moss from growing. So this is where I would suggest maybe start with that soil test, see what the pH is.
That's a good point.
You know, we do know that, you know, moss does tend to like shady areas, but we can also find it in full sun, too. So there's something probably in your soil that's not quite right. So I'd start with the soil test. And I don't know, what you said, is this a sandy soil or?
Oh, it's more of a clay soil.
Okay, so that, getting back to Larry's comment, maybe the moisture is causing, you know, the moss to be more favored over other plants. Or, I mean, do you mulch the area underneath this at all or no?
I do a little bit, and then I, you know, fertilize it and stuff. But even when I'm out there in the spring and I remove by hand, you know, most of the moss, it just comes right back, so...
Yeah. I would suggest, like I said, you know, doing that soil test and seeing if you can't correct any deficiencies. And I'm a big fan of using mulches underneath plants, especially perennials like, you know, shrubs and trees. And that way the soil is covered and, you know, the moss shouldn't grow through the mulch either.
And when you do your soil test or when you send that in, be sure to indicate that you have moss that you want to get rid of.
Okay.
And that'll cue them in to some things. Thanks, Marlis. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Tom in Milwaukee. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I use this Mill Organite for my lawn, and I also had great growth out of my apple trees this year, a lot of blossoms and a lot of apples. And I'm just wondering if that that Mill Organite, first of all, going to help the apple trees next year because of you said that the fruit really takes a lot out of the soil. So that's number one. And is my soil maybe healthier than other people who use a lot of sprays? And you know, they have no dandelions. I still have the dandelions, but for some reason, I think my soil is probably a little bit healthier. Am I right with that? Thank you.
I would agree with you. I mean, everybody's got their opinion on how to manage their properties, their landscapes, and You know, if you choose to spray out the dandelions and use, you know, different products to do that, you know, I just always remind people, well, what impact is that having potentially on that soil life that's in there, you know, the bacteria and the microorganisms? And, you know, it's probably not having a dramatic impact, but, you know, there's always that question, you know, what is the overriding impacts of using some of those chemical-type products. But as far as the milorganite, I mean, that's a fantastic byproduct that's coming out of the Milwaukee sewage treatment district down there. I'm very familiar with, you know, how it's used. And so, that, again, that's another one of those organic materials that we're adding to our soil to build up the organic matter, provide nutrients. So I would continue to use that if it's working for you. When you mentioned the biennial fruit production, that's probably not so much related to fertility as it is just the morphology or physiology of the apple tree. Apples have a tendency to go into that biennial production where they bear heavy one year and hardly the next. So I don't know, is that kind of what you saw this year, and does that seem correct?
Tom, are you there? Oops, sorry. Are you there, Tom?
Yeah. The blossoms froze, and then I didn't have a good production. But this year, that was fantastic. The production of apples was just out of this world. So you're thinking maybe next year it'll be maybe a lesser crop.
That's a likely scenario. You know, trees are just wonderful at reproducing, and some years they put all their fruit in one basket, and there's not a lot that they can do the following year. They need to kind of take a rest. So that may just be part of that. But, you know, again, if you're happy with the milorganite and it's working for you, great, keep using it. But like we said, you know, if you want to just monitor things, you know, you might take a soil test and just see where things are at. And you might be surprised that, you know, you don't need to add anything more.
Well, there you go. Okay. Thanks, Tom. And milorganite comes up from time to time. People say, well, can I use that in vegetable garden, like, you know, for carrots and potatoes and that sort of thing, onions?
You know, I'd have to look at the label. You know, my assumption is through their processing and, you know, how that product is made, that if they're selling it as a soil amendment and a fertilizer, that it should be fine as far as any concerns applying it directly to the soil and planting root vegetables. Now, if you're using composted manure or fresh manure, that's a different story because we know that there's pathogens that might, you know, cause some concern.
Absolutely. Well, Judy in Grafton is with us next. Hi, Judy.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about my lasagna garden. I did that last year, and this year, my carrots did not grow long or deep into it. And when I dig into my lasagna garden, it seems there is such a tangled up mess of debris that really hasn't broken down. I'm wondering if for next year, if I should rototill that, which I know you're not supposed to do with a lasagna garden, but it just doesn't seem to be breaking down. Or should, you know, and if I rototill it, would I do it now or in spring?
Well, for those that aren't familiar with lasagna gardening, I mean, it's basically composting, you know, in a box that, you know, so you have these different layers. Maybe you start with newspaper and then you put some green material, some fresh lawn clippings and maybe some straw and then some compost. And so you're alternating layers, typically of what we call brown materials and green materials. And then, of course, on the top, you want to have a nice, rich, organic, you know, kind of topsoil that goes in the, you know, in this box. And all you're really doing is creating a compost pile to grow your plants in. And it just takes a while for those materials to, you know, to break down. And perhaps, you know, there's not enough water or there's not enough nitrogen there to help break down some of those high carbon materials. And, you know, so you think of it as a compost pile, because that's kind of, you know, what's happening over time. All that material breaks down. So if you feel you've got to kind of jumpstart that process a little bit and you want to mix that up, I would say, you know, you have every right to do that, and maybe it's a way to kind of incorporate more nitrogen into that system. And you could do that now. I mean, we're getting a little late in the year for microorganisms to do their thing, but you know, any kind of nitrogen is going to help, you know, break that down a little bit further.
Sure.
And, you know,
I have a pile of grass clippings. Mm-hmm. Would that be good to incorporate now with the, that's got lots of nitrogen, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. If it's not treated, so you know, depending on
I never treat it.
There you go. I mean, that's the other thing I always caution people about when they're adding materials to their garden is know the source. You know, be comfortable with that.
Right.
You know, because you know if and I've had this happen where people have gotten grass clippings from a lawn service company and they say, wow, this is great organic material, and they use it for mulch. Well, you know, guess what? There's you know, herbicide residue from some previous, you know, application, and then it leaches into the soil and causes problems. So, grass clippings would be a wonderful thing to add, especially if they're nice and fresh. You know, mix them into that lasagna garden. It's in a box, I'm assuming, some kind of container.
It's an 18 by 20 foot garden.
That was a good size one.
Yeah. So you really knocked yourself out to put that together.
I guess so.
Oh, I did. It was a good 2 feet high. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of settled over winter, just like the book says.
Yep.
But I just, you know, my beans grew because I, you know, I made just a little ditch and put some garden soil in and put my bean seeds in and my peas. All of that worked out really well. But my carrots did not grow. My red beets did not grow. And they're above ground. So I don't know what if there was just not the right mixture or what.
Well, like I said, I mean, it's a composting, you know, dynamic system there, and it could be that there wasn't enough, you know, nutrients. You know, maybe potassium was a little lacking for, you know, some of those root crops to develop.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks, Judy, for calling. We are talking with Kevin Sheshow today, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Great to have him along for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening into this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest Kevin Sheshow, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Just to let you know, next week on Garden Talk, Ed Lyon comes by from the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus, and he'll talk about the growing season and the drought a little bit, and so that'll be fun. But right now, Kevin Sheshow talking with us about plants, soil health. Great to have him along. Thanks for listening. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's take a call from Sherry next in Ellison Bay. Sherry, hi.
Yeah, hi there. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a question about, well, I should say I'm not about my soil because I'm up in the tip of the Door County Peninsula and there is no soil up here practically.
Yeah.
You know, I can put a shovel in about an inch and a half, you know. So I figured I would try straw bale gardening this mm-hmm. year. The property I live on is basically in the woods, but I do have a little clearing over the septic field, and I got about 18 straw bales. And I did a little research on the internet, but I was wondering if you had any ideas about should I use what little topsoil I can scrape up to sprinkle on the top of these bales as they sit out over the winter? Should I bother with that? And also in the spring, do you have some kind of idea of what fertilizer I can use that's not chemically derived? You know, I know you have to use some nitrogen supplement with a straw bale garden. Do you have any ideas about this?
Okay, well, straw bale gardening is very similar to the lasagna gardening. It's basically, you know, you're creating a medium for plants to grow in, and the straw bale is that kind of starting block. But you have to think about that. That's all carbon, or mostly carbon, that's tied up in that, you know, in that straw.
Okay.
So, you know, based on the information you've probably read about or maybe the books, you know, they always recommend getting kind of that jump started with some kind of pre-composting and that kind of thing. So, You can do that now. I don't, you know, the temperatures, like I said, are probably going the wrong way for a lot of biology to happen in that straw bale. But, you know, if you can get some of that to decompose, and that's where the nitrogen comes in to play. So, you know, again, I haven't tried this myself, but I think the concept is you get the composting to occur in that top portion of the bale, and that's where you maybe add you know, a high nitrogen source, and that's where the manures would come in if you can find some nitrogen.
Yeah, I do have a potential source of chicken manure, and I've heard that's
excellent.
Very high in nitrogen.
Yes,
it is very high, but you want to obviously you want to
use that carefully. That's what
compost
I've
heard.
Right. Well, you know, you could try sprinkling some of those bales with the with the manure right now. And
yes.
I think one of the concepts is to cover it with plastic or something to create a little greenhouse thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that too. Yeah,
I tried it this last year and I really liked it a lot. We just experimented with just one bale, and I had three tomato plants and that produced a lot of tomatoes.
Really?
And oh yeah, and I had an eggplant coming out the side, and some rosemary and thyme. Growing out the side of the bale, and the tomatoes were growing out the top. However, I have to say that I used a commercial fertilizer in the beginning. I used plants, so that the plants came with a little bit of soil, obviously. And I think that helped get them started. But I had a tremendous crop from that one little bale. Well, it wasn't little. It was a pretty good size.
Yeah.
Straw bale, and it's, you know, obviously over the season, I had to start in the spring with 10 days of watering it for 10 straight days.
Right, okay.
And there's, I actually got sort of excited about it just by having a guy on who's written a book about straw bale gardening, and we may be able to, Joel Karsten, Judith is reminding me, so I interviewed him about it. He's got a book out. We can post the book, or you can.
Yeah, I can look that up at the library.
You can look it up at the library. It's a very detailed description of how to do it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm just excited about, you know, thinking about the concept that, yeah, maybe I can put chicken manure down now on top of them and then cover
right.
them with plastic. That seems like a better way to, you know, to if there's any biology that can occur
yep.
in these cool temperatures, it will. So that's,
right, and that's where the plastic comes in because, you know, that'll hold in some heat and make a little greenhouse effect in there.
Right.
And, you know, that's what kickstarts that biology. And at some point it's going to, you know, get so cold that that'll all stop. But.
Yeah.
It'll start up again in the spring, and
yep.
and by then you should have everything ready to go for your plants.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it.
I'm excited about being able to hopefully grow vegetables in, you know, the middle of woods and up in Door County. So this is Peninsula, so hopefully that'll work out.
And we got an email from Chris in McQuantico who's, you know, said, you know, as seniors who have people who are in apartments,
mm-hmm.
One straw bale on concrete or even asphalt.
Yeah, I've
you can
heard
grow.
That.
It'll support, you know, two or three tomato plants like it did for me, and it
yeah,
was.
I'm just sitting here nodding my head, going, "Yes, I'm all for this because anything we can do to encourage people to grow their own food and experience nature and work with plants, and if that means doing it in a straw bale or in a 5-gallon bucket or, you know, any small container, and just, you know, don't deny yourself of that joy of gardening because you don't have, you know, a 10 by 10 you know, open backyard traditional garden.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited. Thank you very much for your input. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Sherry. Yeah,
you're welcome.
Okay, thanks. Sure, bye-bye.
Bye. And while we're at it, I've got to mention, I'm just looking online at my Facebook page, and I see a picture of Limey, my lime tree, and I wanted to mention it on the Garden Talk program because there are many, often people might only be listening to Garden Talk during the course of the week, and I wanted to mention somebody had asked me to post a picture of our lime tree, which my daughter named Limey, and I have it up on my Facebook page, and there's three limes on it, and we've already had 131 people look at it and 24 comments, and so we've had a lot of fun with Limey on my so just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And you can see what my lime tree looks like. It cranks limes, I'm telling you. It's a very good lime tree. Ah, man. Tim in Milwaukee, thank you for calling.
Yeah, how you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Good. I had a question. I moved into a house in December, and I'm a first-time homeowner, and I don't know anything about gardening, but I have huge rose bushes in the backyard, and one of them looks like it's about a month ago, all the leaves started turning brown. I don't know if that's just the process of them going into winter sleep, and I don't know how often I should water them or if I should fertilize them or anything like that. I don't know if you could help me out in that area.
So you inherited these from the previous owner?
Yeah, they're they're probably 5 feet around and 4 or 5 feet tall. They're huge, and they produce tons of flowers, and I just want to keep them up, but I don't know what to do with them or if I, or how often I should water them or fertilize them or really anything.
So some type of shrub rose, huh?
Yeah, my guess
they,
was...
But I was going to say they have the most thorns I've ever seen on a rose bush. They're just covered in thorns.
All right. Well,
well, roses aren't necessarily my strong suit, but, I mean, just the fact that you've got this beautiful plant that seems to be thriving. I mean, a bush that size, it's obviously been there for a while. It must be, you know, somewhat happy with its environment. And, you know, I would say, you know, the leaf drop that you're seeing is likely due to, you know, just seasonal leaf drop as things get, you know, ready for winter and go dormant. There are some leaf spot diseases that roses sometimes get. Black spot is probably the most common. But I guess at this point, I don't think you need to necessarily do anything too drastic. Just, you know, observe them and enjoy them. And, you know, you might need to do some corrective pruning if, you know, they're getting a little out of hand.
Oh, yeah. I did that when we first moved in, cut the ones that were growing 4 feet off the plant and tied them up to kind of pull them all together. And then... just general watering on plants. How often do you say I should water outdoor plants?
Yeah, your soil type, is that going to be a little on the heavier side at your location there? It's not like a real droughty sand.
I'm down by the airport. It's pretty much just dirt, you know, just 8, 12 inches of dirt.
Yeah, so my guess is it's got an ability to hang on to a fair amount of moisture. But, you know, if it's in an environment where it's you know, getting lots of sun, and maybe there's asphalt or other, you know, concrete surfaces around there that might, you know, make that microclimate a little hotter and drier. You know, you got to keep in mind that that's going to stress the plant. So our typical rule of thumb we often talk about is 1 inch of water per week is something to kind of keep in mind as you think about the weather. And you know, you can just stick your finger down into the soil and see, you know, what does it feel like? And if it looks like feels like it's dry, well, then you got to give it some water.
All right, great. And, yeah, I was kind of neat to buy the house in the winter and then see everything that came up in the summer. It was a woman that had been there for 30 years, and me and my family bought it, and it was kind of neat to see all the flowers popping up. And, yeah, it's just a neat experience.
Yeah.
Well, you got yourself all kinds of fun.
Yeah, all kinds of fun. Thanks a lot, Tim. And good luck with that home. Jackie in Richland County, hi.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
Well, yesterday I planted peas. This is outdoors. I planted peas, lettuce, spinach, radish. And I mulched over it. And just wondering if there's any chance that in May they will come up.
Ooh, so you're employing what we call dormant seeding, or you could say some people call it frost seeding, although that's usually done later in the winter, early spring. You know, what do seeds need to germinate? You know, they need moisture, sunlight maybe, if they're depending on how close to the surface they need to be, but they also need the proper soil temperature. So is with the mulch that you covered them up with, I'm assuming that's going to keep the soil cold enough that they shouldn't germinate. So you just did this so you could get a jump start on spring, and if there's seeds there to germinate in March or April, you'll be, you know, able to enjoy those plants that much sooner. Is that your thinking?
That's what I'm hoping, yeah.
I mean, I'm always one to encourage experimentation and be creative. You know, the challenge is going to be keeping those seeds viable. They shouldn't dry out because you got them covered. You know, the mulch will protect them from super cold temperatures. The only concern is, you know, are mice or other critters going to find them between now and the right conditions in, you know, in March or April? And if we get a really, really warm spell, there's always that chance that the soil temperature warms up enough that they sprout now.
Yeah.
So
you don't want that.
No, you don't. I guess I give you credit for trying something different.
Good for you, Jackie. What the heck? Give it a shot. And the other thing, of course, is in spring, too. You might get a warm spell for a week or two, and then some cold weather comes in and just knocks them out. But
right. It's a chance we take.
It's a chance we take, and I applaud your efforts, Jackie. Thank you so much for calling and planting those peas and radishes and lettuce, hoping they're going to come up in the spring. I really do hope that they do come up in the spring. Kevin Shesho, our guest today. He is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties, and he provides information and education to farmers and to homeowners like you and like me, and he's willing to do it. He really enjoys it, especially likes talking about soils. He's our guest on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Friday means Garden Talk. Today we're visiting with one of the great UW Extension horticulture and agriculture agents. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Kevin Shesho, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett and Sawyer and Washburn counties. And he does a lot of work with area farmers on crops and soils and alternative agriculture. He works with Master Gardener Volunteer Program. He coordinates that one for the Tri-County area. And he manages the Teaching and Display Garden at Spooner Ag Research Station. And he also organizes horticulture workshops and field days, special interest in soil ecology and composting. And his degrees, bachelor's and master's in soil science from UW-Madison and River Falls. And Kevin, once again, great to have you with us today.
Oh, I'm having fun.
It's a lot of fun, isn't it?
You bet.
I really enjoy it. You know, we have great listeners, and they ask pretty darn good questions, too. Nancy in Franklin has a question for you, so let's go to her. Nancy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I'm here in the southeast part of the state, and I want to comment on the growing of or the sowing of seeds in the fall so that they will come up early in the spring. I've done this for about 5 years and have had great success with spinach and carrots.
Cool.
It seems that they have a long enough germination time that when I sow them in November, just did this last week, when I sow them in November, they don't come up. Because even if we have a day or two that it's nice, because they take 14 days to germinate. And what happens is that I have carrots coming up and beautiful spinach ready to pick way before you could ever get in to even plant in the spring. And so April, May, I'm picking spinach.
Oh.
The carrots get so big that by July, I'm able to just start eating out of the garden. Carrots that persist into the fall that I haven't eaten, they get huge. So I've increased the pounds of produce just by this step. And you know what? I don't cover them with mulch. Just plant them like I would in the spring. Let them be.
Well, you have got to be the envy of everybody in your neighborhood.
That's what you love about Wisconsin Public Radio listeners. They are so knowledgeable.
And they've got really know
all kinds of wonderful life experiences. And this is just another one of those alternative gardening techniques that people discover. And that's the beauty of doing all this stuff on your own backyards and discovering on your own what works. And, hey, I learned something that reinforced something that I guess I didn't think as much about as I used to.
Yeah. Thank you, Nancy. So, again, just to review, what are the seeds that you plant?
I had success with spinach and carrots.
Spinach and carrots.
When I've planted lettuce, romaine lettuce, one plant came up. But, you know, lettuce germinates really quickly.
Yeah.
So it's, and same with cabbage didn't come up either.
Yeah, yeah, I can understand.
You know, I would keep trying things, you know.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you for taking my call here.
Yeah, thanks, Nancy. Great call, as they all are. We had some great great callers, great listeners. Helen in Prentice has a question. Hi, Helen. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry and Kevin. My question isn't with planting. It's more with killing.
Okay.
We're overrun with buckthorn.
Ugh.
And I'm wondering if now is the time to get rid of it or if spring is a better time. I've pulled all the little ones that I can. Now I'm to the bigger ones, and I don't know. I know there's a chemical to put on it to kill it, to go in, you know, down into the roots once I cut it. But I don't know if that's going to hurt the soil or not.
Yeah, actually, fall is an ideal time to, you know, control buckthorn. It is one of those shrubby, woody invasives that we've...
It's terrible.
Yeah, and there's lots of information out there on proper techniques for controlling this. I think, unfortunately, to really, unless you want to do lots of physical, mechanical, you know, removal of the plant on those larger stumps, where the one technique is, you know, to cut that stump and treat it with some kind of herbicide product.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't have that information right in front of me, but I know that if you go to the Invasive Plant Association of Wisconsin website, IPAW, they have all kinds of information on invasives and what's the proper strategies for managing and controlling, you know, the spread of these things. So I would suggest going there to get the specifics. But this is still a perfect time because the plants are going dormant and they're taking nutrients down into their root system. And I think, you know, there's still that window, although it's probably closing quickly, to get that herbicide application painted or brushed onto the stumps of those cut larger diameter you know, shrubs.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you need to do it pretty quick.
Yes. And what was the website?
Well, it's the Invasive Plant Association of Wisconsin, or IPAW. So
okay.
If you did an internet search on, you know, IPAW or Invasive Plants Association of Wisconsin, I'm sure you'd find them. And, you know, on their website, they're going to have information on how to manage and control all kinds of invasives.
We'll post
Thank
it up
you.
On our Facebook page, too. Thank
okay.
you very much, Helen, for calling. Appreciate it. And you can join in, too. We have finally have open lines again for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. An email from Rosie in Appleton. What's the best method for adding manure to vegetable gardens? What type, when does it get mixed into the existing soil?
Yeah, I think we commented a little earlier on this, too, when it comes to using some of our organic manures. You know, we got to be concerned about pathogens and making sure we're not putting unintentionally, you know, putting contaminants onto our, especially vegetables. And that's where we need to make sure they're composted. And we like to give at least 60 to 90 days between when the fresh manure is applied and when the, you know, vegetables are planted. Again, I don't have it in front of me, but we do have information, a fact sheet on using and applying fresh manures to garden soil. And again, there, you know, our concern is if there are pathogens, we want to give the biology in the soil or the composting process plenty of time to kind of, you know, sterilize or clean up some of those potential pathogens so they're not a health concern.
Terry in Green Bay, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment on, especially the lady up in Door County, like a good plant food or fertilizer that's more of somewhat organic, let's say natural, and it's right out of Egg Harbor, and it's called mm-hmm. Follett's Watches Grow. It's a liquid mm-hmm. plant food that you dilute with water. You can use it in containers. You can use it in beds. My father-in-law, when he was living, used to spray. He had a commercial cucumber squash, and he'd spray that right over the leaves. It's taken in by the leaves, and also what goes into the soil, the roots take it up.
Hmm. And what's it called?
Follett's Watches Grow.
Oh, Follett's Watches Grow. Okay.
He's been around since the 50s. Mr. Yeah. Farmer developed it, and now he's passed on, and his grandson operates the business. I've got nothing to do with it, but I've used it for years, and it's a great natural type of plant.
Yeah, watch this grow. Yeah, I know that product. Thanks, Terry. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And we'll take some more calls here. Jim in Green Bay. Let's see if you got. We can get you on here. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you there? Ah, lost him. Okay, well, let's try an email here from Ed in Bassett. He wonders if there's a good book or resource for information on soil microbiota. I'm interested in learning about the differences in pH and fungi and bacteria between prairie, woodlot, and garden soils. Wondering also if there's value in inoculating a soil if trying to encourage a prairie restoration from a farmland.
Well, I just happened to bring along some reference books just for this question.
Oh,
there's lots of great information out there. Don't get me wrong. The internet is full of it. You just have to, you know, go through that whole process of making sure it's appropriate for your applications. But the two that I have in my office that I, refer to and I always set out when I talk about soil, one's a pretty simple read. It's called Life in a Bucket of Soil by Alvin Silverstein and Virginia Silverstein. And it's kind of a kid's book, but, you know, it just simplifies things in a really, concise way about all the different things that are in the soil, some of that microbiology. So that would be one resource. Another one is called Teeming with Microbes, A Gardener's Guide to the Soil Food Web. And that's
cool.
written by Wayne Lewis, Jeff Lowenfelds, and Elaine Ingham. And I believe, Larry, I did send you in an email, I think I made some reference to both of those. So that might be something
they
want to...
We'll post those, too. We can post those up on my Facebook page.
Yeah, they want to check out. There are soil biology primers and other great educational resources that the Natural Resources Conservation Service, it's part of USDA, they've got a whole initiative going right now on soil health and soil quality. And I also think I sent those links to you earlier, and we can post those on the website later as well. But their business is soil and soil conservation. So they've got all kinds of information related to soil microbiology and soil health and what we can do to improve that. Mm-hmm. So those would be some, I think, starting points.
Yep, good starting points.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Paulette and Hayward, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a question about the planting apple trees and if it's still possible at this time of year in northern Wisconsin, we're zone 3 in Hayward, to still plant apple trees or we should wait.
Are these apple trees in containers that, you know, you...
They would be in containers, yes.
Sure, sure. No, I don't think it's too late. I mean, basically, you know, if we can still... dig in the soil, and I think we're starting to freeze our top layer of soil in, you know, northwestern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And, there's two trains of thoughts here. You know, if it was a little earlier in the fall, that root ball, when you place it in the soil, would still have some time and the temperatures would be appropriate that there might be some root growth and some, you know, establishing happening below the soil. But when we get a little later like this, you're basically just keeping that plant dormant. And, you know, obviously you don't want to leave it in the pot. It's going to be exposed to, you know, too cold a temperature. So definitely protect that root ball somehow. I mean, if you don't want to permanently put it in a spot, you can always, you know, heal it in is a term that we use where, you just find a spot to bury that that root ball and mulch it with leaves and cover it up good to provide insulation, and then in the spring you can lift it out and put it in that permanent spot. If you've already got a permanent spot picked out, as long as you can still, you know, manipulate the soil and get a nice planting bowl. I like to think of planting trees in a bowl rather than a hole, and then spread the roots out and put some mix some compost in with the native soil and get it watered in and mulched, I think, you know, you still have an opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first couple inches are a little frozen, but I think below that it's workable.
Yeah, and if it is... Go ahead.
I had one other question about mm-hmm. the distance between apple trees in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
How far apart should they be?
Yeah, do you know...
I add two more.
Do you know what rootstock these trees are on? I mean, they're often referred to as standard dwarf or semi-dwarf.
I think they're semi-dwarf.
Mm-hmm, that's very common. Mm-hmm. And again, the rootstock is what dictates the size of the tree when it, you know, when it grows up and is mature. So, you know, with these semi-dwarf trees, they'll grow, you know, 15.
Good size.
Yeah, they can get pretty good size. So you have to think, you know, how much space is that tree going to need when it's happy, fully grown? So I would say a minimum of 12 to somewhere around 15 feet between trees would be best. That way you've got plenty of room for them to spread out, and they're not going to compete with each other.
And that's still close enough to have good pollination, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Bees and other insects will travel, you know, quite a long distance to help us with pollination.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. You've helped.
All right. Thanks a lot, Paul. How much snow do you have there in Hayward?
Well, none right now, but we've had a couple good snows. In fact, we've been out skiing already.
Ah, all right. I'll be up your way here in a week or so, so I'm just wondering. Thank you very much for that call. Mike in Baraboo, turn to you next. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My call is in regards to the gentleman that had called in earlier about stockpiling soil around mining or quarries and stuff.
Yeah.
We had a similar issue a few years ago, and one of the gentlemen that spoke at one of our meetings, he contradicted or somewhat of what your guest said as far as the soil going sterile. Part of that answer should, I believe, according to what I understood, was how long is it going to be stockpiled? Now, if it's 6 months or a few years, chances are the nutrients are still there. But if it's going to be an extended period of time, a good portion of those nutrients will be gone. And a lot of these companies get contracts that go, you know, 10, 20 years. So, therefore, we were led to believe that the soil would be quite sterile by that time.
Mm, yeah, well, if it goes 20 years.
Yeah, I can understand, you know, that being a concern. I guess I don't have a lot of, you know, personal experience with, you know, that industry. But, again, I'm just, again, trying to think intuitively here about what's going on in that pile of soil over time. And you're right, you know, if it sits there for an extended period of time, you're going to have, you know, chemical, physical, biology happening to that, and through the leaching or maybe the heating up, maybe it composts a little bit because it's in this big mass. You know, it's not in its native state anymore. So, yeah, things are going to happen over time, and I can see where, you know, there's going to be substantial changes. Just how much, I don't know. Obviously, it's never going to be like it was when it was in its native topsoil.
No, absolutely not. Thanks, Mike.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yep. Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Leah emailed us, lives in a woods outside Washburn, has a ton of red oaks around our very sandy soil. Anything I can use these tons of waxy leaves that seem to last forever for enhancing my soil for vegetable gardening? We currently garden in raised beds and bring soil in. I'd love to use this plentiful resource to my advantage.
And leaves are wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful to have, you know, and those of us living in the North Woods, or even if you got a couple trees in your backyard, you're always dealing with that leaf drop in the fall. And what do you do with all those leaves? And
I run the lawnmower through them.
Exactly. You know, it's an organic material. It's maybe not, you know, ready to add to our soils as a, you know, as a unprocessed leaf, but if you just rake them into, if you've got the space and you can make, you know, just a pile of leaves, you know, let them just sit and rot on their own. It may take several years to do that, but mulch mowing, running the lawnmower over them and incorporating them just, you know, into the lawn, like you had mentioned, Larry, What I like to do with them is actually run the leaves through a mower, and then I add grass clippings to that, and I mix them about 50-50, and you make this wonderful leaf mold. It's kind of a hot compost method. It takes, you know, maybe 3 to 6 weeks, depending on the time of year and how, you know, much water you add and that kind of thing. But leaves can be a wonderful addition to our soil. We just have to do a little bit of processing with them and think about it a little bit differently. I would, you know, try to look at ways to get them to break down a little bit. And, again, it's where you got to add maybe a little bit of nitrogen to speed up that process if you don't want to wait several years for that, you know, to occur on its own.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a really impressive master gardener display garden up there that's won some awards, hasn't it, Kevin?
Oh, we are so fortunate, and I am so fortunate in my position to be stationed. My office is physically located at the Spooner Ag Research Station there, just outside of Spooner on Highway 70. And we've got this wonderful display garden. It's taken us about 15 years to develop. It's now our teaching and display garden. I use it all the time for garden walks, where we bring people out and have little informal conversations and classes. And I use it for my Master Gardener class. The school kids come out. We have an annual Twilight Garden Tour, and we invite our university specialists, you know, Phil Pelletieri and Brian Huddleston. Bob Tomish has come up when he was around. So we've used that space extensively over the years, and it is a real gem. And you're right, we did recently receive an award through the All-America Selections, which is a national organization that highlights and promotes new varieties of vegetables and flowers. And we entered their design landscape design contest, and to our surprise, we were selected as a second-place winner for the nation. So we competed against about 16 other gardens, and we are extremely happy. And, again, our Master Gardener volunteers, and I know there's a bunch of you out there listening right now, and, you know, hats off to all Master Gardeners and all volunteers who help make our communities better through gardening, and whether it's school gardens or community gardens or beautification projects. I mean, you know, Master Gardener or not, plants just add so much more to our landscapes and provide us with food and, you know, the beauty and the enjoyment of it all. So, yes, this garden is a real, I'm extremely proud of what we've done out there, and it is open to the public. So anybody who's traveling down Highway 53 heading north or south, we're just, you know, a half mile off of there on Highway 70 north on Orchard Lane. You can find us on Facebook.
I haven't been there. We on Facebook as well.
Yeah, we got a Facebook page, Spooner Ag Research Station. We have a website as well, and we've got information posted on there of what we do and some things like that. And
well, Kevin, you know what? Mm-hmm. We're out of time. I tell you, we've had a great time. Thank you so much for being with us. You'll come back and be with us again.
Well, if you'll have me, you know, and I don't want to, I don't want to steal a line from Kevin McKinley, but you know, he's a host on one of your shows. But he always ends his show with, you know, spend less, have more.
and with that, we are out of time. Thanks, Kevin Sheshow, Ag Development Agent for UW Extension. Thank you for listening.